From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with Catherine Davis, Vermont author of 8 novels, including Duplex, which is the book we discussed in 2013. She's the senior fiction writer on the faculty of the writing program at Washington University. Duplex was a New York Times Book Review editor's choice and one of the millions most anticipated books of 2013. Mary and Eddie are meant for each other, but love is no guarantee, not in these suburbs. Like all children, they exist in an eternal present. Time is imminent, and the adults of the street live in their assorted houses like numbers on a clock. Meanwhile, ominous rumors circulate, and the increasing agitation of the neighbors points to a future in which all will be lost. Soon, a sorcerer's car will speed down Mary's street, and as past and future fold into each other, the resonant parenthesis of her girlhood will close forever. Beyond is adulthood, a world of robots and sorcerers, slaves and masters, bodies without souls. In Duplex, Catherine Davis, whom the Chicago Tribune has called one of the most inventive novelists at work today, has created a coming-of-age story like no other. Once you enter the duplex, that magical hinge between past and future, human and robot, space and time, there's no telling where you might come out. When I spoke with Catherine in 2013, I asked her to begin by reading from Duplex. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Body without soul. It was a suburban street, one block long, the houses made of brick and built to last like the third little pigs. Sycamore trees had been planted at regular intervals along the curb, and the curbs themselves sparkled. I think the concrete was mixed with mica in it. I think when it was new, the street couldn't help but draw attention to itself, inviting envy. Miss Vicks lived at the lower end of the street in number 49. Most of the other houses had families living in them, but she was by herself, a woman of about 50, slim and still attractive, with a red, short-haired dachshund. By the time she moved in, the sycamore trees had grown so large they had enormous holes cut through their crowns to make room for all the wires. She was a real woman. You could tell by the way she didn't have to move her head from side to side to take in sound. Every day, she and the dachshund went for 3 walks, the first early in the morning, the second in the late afternoon, and the third after dinner, when the blue-green lights of the scows, those slow-moving heralds of melancholy, would begin to appear in the night sky. The little dog would sniff around the feet of the sycamores, and as it did, she would stand there paralyzed, as all the Miss Vixes that had ever been layered themselves inside her, one atop the other and increasingly small, forming a great laminate like tree rings around heartwood.
Thank you for reading that. So I'll just say that was Catherine Davis reading from Duplex, which is published by Grey Wolf Press. So I wanted to know what you knew for sure about this novel as you set out to write it.
I knew very little for sure, and this book, it took me a long time to figure out exactly what book it was I wanted to be writing this time around. And so it wasn't until I was writing a fairy tale for Kate Bernheimer's collection of modern fairy tales.
Oh, wow.
And it was when I heard the sound of what I actually just read in my head, the sound of that voice was, to me, absolutely the right voice to tell the story I wanted to tell, and then I knew that the world I was entering and wanted to describe had this sort of fairy tale quality to it, even though it was also the street I grew up on.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I knew that, then I began to know a lot of other things about the book. And I had already, in a variety of false starts, encountered some characters, like Miss Vix, like the sorcerer, and this pair, Mary and Eddie. There were things I had, but I hadn't really figured out how they all came together. But the minute I wrote those first paragraphs, I saw, but not, you know, literally the whole thing, but the world became vivid and alive for me.
So that you could start entering it.
Exactly.
I love the first line. Do you mind if I read it again, the first line?
No.
Just to remind people before I ask you about it. So the first line is, "It was a suburban street, one block long, the houses made of brick and built to last like the third little pigs." I love that. And I felt like bringing in the little pigs right there made us realize that it would have a fairy tale quality to it right there at the beginning. But then there's also suburbia right there at the beginning, which is, you know, the book is about a place that we're familiar with, and yet it's a place that we totally are not familiar with.
Right, right.
And the first page was so recognizable that I actually made a little note to myself to look up scows, because I'm like, what are scows? I've never heard that word. I didn't realize
that
we were going great into a place that I did not think that I didn't know. So did you feel you had to begin this way to draw your reader in gradually through the normalcy of a world we would recognize?
I think when I started, mm-hmm. I felt like I was, in a way, quite literally describing the street I grew up on.
And where was that?
In Philadelphia.
Okay. And
it was within the city limits, though, right on the edge. So it had a very suburban feel. It was a street that had been built for mostly young families after the war. The fathers came home and families began. It was the very beginning of the baby boom.
Okay.
And so the street, it was a block long, and the houses were made out of brick. And I do remember thinking when I was a kid, hearing the story of the three little pigs, well, our houses are going to last. I mean, I had that thought. So in a way, even though there were no scows going through the sky, it's very autobiographical in that way, and in the time period, too, the period of the early 50s, I wanted that feeling of that world, which could feel very much like the past, but it also could feel like the future. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the way that there were scows in the sky or a robot family on the block.
Yeah, exactly. And talking about your own life in the book, another area that you talk about your own life, and I know this because you actually mentioned it in our last interview. I asked you about your history as a writer, and I remember you saying in our interview that you used to write stories about horses in marbleized notebooks.
That's right.
And in this book, you talk about the girls who write stories about horses in marbleized notebooks, and I was like, I recognize that.
And I tried. I don't have those anymore. I have some books that my mother kept.
Right.
But I don't have any of the horse stories. I tried duplicating my own highly ornate writing style that had informed one of these novels.
Okay. And then I forgot to look back. Did you name one of the novels the same as one of the ones that you wrote when you were a kid?
Probably. I mean, they all had the names of the horses.
Of the horses.
And they were all the names that we dreamed up because we thought we were going to win these contests where you name a racehorse and then you win it. And it was touching, the names we came up with, thinking that they were so original and great, like thunder. But those then would be the titles of the horse books.
Okay. Now, where did the scows come into play? When did you discover scows were going to be part of this world?
Kind of right away. I wanted something in the sky that indicated that this was not the world we know and love, that right. there was something different. And
And I didn't want it to be anything very aggressively foreign. I thought the word scow didn't really suggest much of anything except, you know, like maybe a garbage scow, so that it wouldn't make you feel like the world was under attack.
And it's melancholy, I think, right, is what you say.
Yeah. One of the things about the scows in the sky, or just the fact of something in the sky, again, in a way, literally returns to the world of, the street was called Wooddale Road, where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had been thinking about a lot about how your perception of what's going on around you when you're a kid can sometimes seem very fantastic or science fiction-like,
mm-hmm.
In a way that as you get older you realize, well, that's why that was there, and those people seemed weird, but they weren't really robots. And and when I was a kid, if an airplane flew by overhead, people would yell, "There's an airplane going overhead." It was a big deal for an airplane to pass by. And you'd come out of your houses and you'd all look up at the airplane. And I mean, there was no sense of threat.
Was that a time thing, or do you think it also had to do with city limits things? You know, being in the city, do you think there were fewer?
I think it was a time thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there weren't that many airplanes flying around.
Okay.
And so it was a big, exciting thing if an airplane flew overhead. And then that gradually changed as we got more into, you know, the end of the 50s and the Cold War amped up, and then people were terrified about atom bombs being dropped, so that then the airplanes, you still were attentive to the airplanes, but they no longer seemed necessarily innocent. There was the potential for something bad attached to them. And I had all of that I had in mind in creating this world.
Okay. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought this was kind of a pretty dark book for you.
I think it is a dark book.
And darker than your usual books. Is that not true? Or?
I don't know. I have a feeling that at heart, all of the books are fairly dark.
Okay.
Though some of them have a lighter look to them from the outside.
Okay.
But I will say this book felt to me, although it's in no way similar in terms of the plot or really the language, the syntax. Although of course all the books are written by me, so they in some ways sound the same. But this book seemed to me more similar to Hell, which is probably the darkest of the earlier books. So so that makes sense.
Okay, I haven't read that one. I have to admit, so I don't.
But it's more peculiar the way Hell is, I think, even though it has a kind of story going on in it. But there's a peculiar construction to the narrative that, again, isn't like the one in Hell, but is less conventional.
Yeah. I have a question about that. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the rhythm of a novel and how a reader's expectations might change as he or she gets used to the rhythm of the novel and sort of gets into that place that the author is bringing the reader.
I feel like one of the important ways I construct a novel that is, I mean, I don't think it's peculiar just to me, but I definitely approach the construction of plot or the forward motion of the book through the transitions from from piece to piece of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And those.
Do you mean chapter pieces or also other pieces within chapters?
It can be within chapters, but often it is from chapter to chapter. And so the moment where one thing ends mm-hmm. and another thing begins, and the implied space in between those two things, and what your imagination is required to do to get from the ending of chapter A to the beginning of chapter B is for me a huge part of the way the book gets constructed, and I think of it for my own purposes when I'm writing. I think of it very much in I guess musical terms, in that the way something sounds coming to a conclusion mm-hmm. suggests something echoing in the reader's mind or imagination that carries then into the next part. And if that doesn't work, I mean, that requires an enormous amount of adjustment and energy for me when I'm constructing a book, because the pieces are not put together haphazardly, even though sometimes it's not exactly chronological.
And what about within your own schedule? Like, how often do you find that the way that you constructed a first draft will stay in that basic order? Like, are you doing a lot of this transition work the first time through, or do you not worry about it until a revision?
I am doing it the first time through.
Okay.
It's not to say that things don't change in revision, but it's so much a part of the anatomy of the novel. Yeah. It would be like making something that didn't have any bones or any, fiber
right.
holding things together. So that's as much a part of the early construction as, you know, the sentences
yeah.
within a chapter.
Yeah. Okay, great. I love your character development is fun to get into, and your descriptions of characters early on were sometimes joined with explanations, which I enjoyed. Let me just give an example, and then it's less obscure. Mary's part jogs to the left, suggesting a lack of interest in things she couldn't see. I loved that. And her teeth are too big for her mouth, which the narrative tells us makes her appear more vulnerable than she really was. We only know this because the narrative tells us it's so, but then we can start to associate those physical characteristics with these qualities of character, and which we've been told to think about. And I liked that. I wondered if you can talk a little bit about that.
I love the omniscient narrator, and in this book it was a sort of peculiar use of omniscient narrative, because I put an I mm-hmm. in of first person, but only really every now and then does it pop up to the surface, and yet I wanted that sense of an actual sort of human governing presence telling the story, possibly even someone who is part of the world that these people live in, possibly one of the girls on the street.
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit, of the Virgin Suicides, which is, I don't know if you, that was like a we narrative.
Right.
And it really did refer to a certain group, but you kind of lost track of that group and they would just come back in once in a while.
Right. I wanted that sense of this group of girls who are sort of specific to the sections where Janice is
yeah.
telling her stories, but are also clearly the denizens of the street from the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
and that there's a culture that they all participate in. Sort of from the beginnings of their lives to, the very end.
Yeah, because they do age during the...
Yeah.
So when you were writing I, did you have any certain character in mind at those moments or not really?
I really had... I really had in mind me.
Okay. Yeah.
I felt like I, Catherine Davis, was
from Philadelphia.
From Philadelphia, present in those moments. Though I really didn't, I wouldn't want anybody reading the book to think, well, I think I gave plenty of reasons not to think that this is pure autobiography. Oh, no. And yet, I also wanted myself and my investment in this world to be a part of what was happening. Mm-hmm. So it was, I felt that way when I would use the I, and I imagine it probably reads a little bit that way without being overt. Mm-hmm. I hope.
It does. No, definitely. No, and that, yeah. Children are always important in your novels, or in the novels I've read, I have to clarify. And they're very important here. And yes, this narrator, when she pops in as an I, seems to be a child, at least through much of the book. Can you talk about the importance of children in your work?
I think that it's more specifically maybe even adolescence, because that's, a transitional moment in a life. Right. And so that it fascinates me. Moments of transition, to return to the construction of the book, really interest me a lot. And how difficult they are, but also how just full of vitality and life a transition can be if you're not resisting it. So I think that that moment in a human life interests me. I'm also really interested in old people, and clearly there's another transition going on there. So, and I feel like there's something those moments have in common, because there's this whole big middle part of your life where much goes on. And yet the sense of leaving something behind forever and ever, or entering something completely brand new, it's less present in your psyche, I think, in the middle part of your life.
Right.
And that feeling was part of what I wanted the book to be infused with, in terms of living a life, a lifetime.
Right. And no matter what life you're going to have, whether or not you're going to have children or go to school or have a certain kind of career or whatever, you go through those two big phases on the way in and out.
Yeah, there's no way around it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, hopefully you get to live to be old, too.
Right.
So The Rain of Beads is an important story in the book. And then there are others, too. So I wondered if you can talk a little bit about creating an entire culture complete with history and an associated mythology. I mean, there really is, as recognizable as this world might seem to us, they have a different history and mythology than our own.
I knew pretty early on that I wanted, for one thing, I wanted there to be an older girl dispensing so-called wisdom.
Janice.
And I wanted that, the stories that she told, to be presented by her as if they were not stories, but they were the history of the people living on the street. Because in a way, that's how I experience history. It could just as easily not have happened. In a way, you hear a story, and it can vary depending on who's telling you the story.
Right.
And so that idea about our past, and our shared past, which is what history is, really interested me. Uh-huh. And I've also always been very interested in the idea that there was a guy named Fire Robind, maybe Paul Fire Robind, who wrote a book against method, I might not be right about this, but he his basic point was that all of the stories we have about where we came from are, in a way, or can be considered in a way, equally true, true as opposed to, say, factual, in terms of what we became as a culture, a civilization. So everything we know from science is valid, but in a way it's equally valid to think that the world is, you know, an elephant on top of a turtle. And I mean, there's some way that describes something about our experience that is every bit as valid as what science tells us. And I've always been attracted to that. You know, not to say I don't believe what the scientists say. And there was some way I wanted to pay homage to that in this book. And so The Rain of Beads, for example, the first story that Janice tells is an example of a story that could explain why people are the way they are, why they're, you know, worried about letting their daughters out alone on the street, and also why young women are so freaked out early on by, you know, the onset of sexual experience, which can seem, you know, exciting but also horrifying, and that there's a past that had a huge effect on this culture that sounds in a way implausible but also possible.
Okay.
So that was why I did that.
I liked that very early on you made some statement, I didn't write it down exactly, but you made some statement about how I think it was Janice, it tells stories, but she also lies. And I liked that just sort of being out there, kind of like, well, maybe these are true, maybe they're not, but it doesn't matter in some sense because these are the stories.
Right. It's in that very beginning of The Rain of Beads, we're told that at least all the adults on the street considered Janice a liar. And that she, then she said that her mother beat her. She had stripes on her back to prove it. I actually had a friend when I was growing up who told me that her mother beat her and she had stripes on her back, which made a big impression on me. And I remember telling my mother, who said, oh, well, she's just making that up. And and then that sense of, but, you know, who are you going to believe here? And then I finally got the girl, whose name actually was Janet, to show me. And she didn't have anything on her back. Her back was fine, but she said the stripes had gone away. Mm-hmm. So in that way, this is another one of those little autobiographical aspects of the book.
Right.
But I did want the possibility that, you know, this is all just fiction. But then fiction can sometimes really be telling you the truth in a way that the history books don't.
Exactly. Or do.
Or do, right. Exactly.
Okay. This is a quote from the book, and this is one of many, many, many spots in your book that addresses the issue of time. It suddenly came to him that not all that long ago he had been a young man, and that, like his fellow human beings, he had always relied on meaninglessly small units for the measurement of time. And I enjoyed all these little moments in the book that talk about time, the passage of time, and the importance and reality of time in a way. So I was wondering if you researched science and science fiction to come up with your time and space and space drift ideas that are in this book, and also just if you can talk about the fun it must have been for about writing about time.
Well, I've always really been obsessed with time.
Okay.
And only in this book, I realized I was also obsessed with space. I hadn't thought of it so much before. Uh-huh. This book is, I'm not going to say I did absolutely no research, but it was so unresearched compared with, say, Versailles, where I had to do a lot of research.
Right.
And even the thin plays where there were things having to do with the, you know, the small creatures that live in a pond. And I mean, there was a different kind of research I needed to do. Here, I actually hardly did any research at all.
Okay.
Some of the time and space stuff, I mean, I made, you know, a lot of it up, like space drift.
Yeah, I enjoyed that though.
And it's something I've thought about and I've read a lot about over the course of my life. A long time ago when I was teaching at Goddard College, I taught a class on speculative fiction, mm-hmm. and the students also had to read some work about theories of relativity and cosmology and all of these things that, to tell you the truth, I do not really understand, and yet I'm very attracted to in my imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So that was more what was happening. With this book, I wanted to talk about the way I experience time and the way I experience space very directly, and not feel constrained by trying to provide a really, really realistic framework. Because in fact, the way I experience time and space is not, I suppose, what you would call realistic. And I don't think it is for anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have this linear idea about time, and yet the way we operate in the world with, you know, memory and dream and, you know, thinking into the future but dwelling some in the past. I mean, we're really, really not living much of our lives in linear time, unless in a job you have to, you know, be here at a particular moment.
Right.
But I don't feel like that's really part of our nature to be living that way, which is why it makes everybody so stressed out and mm-hmm. and anxious.
Do you think our conception of time is tied fairly specifically to mortality? I mean, I feel like we look at ourselves aging, and so we put ourselves on this linear timeline. And so we put everything else there as well.
I think that's really true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yet, you know, when you think about the way an entire life gets lived, and this also goes back to the little passage I read from the beginning mm-hmm. of the book, where this woman, Miss Vicks, is standing there, but all of the Miss Vixes who came before, going down to when she was a girl, and then when she was a little girl, and then when she was a baby, and then when she was nothing, they're all sort of piled up inside you. It's not as if all of that goes away,
right.
Nor does what you are sort of going to become. So that there's some way, in a moment, we are much more than we perceive ourselves to be.
Mm-hmm.
But that also, definitely, the limitation has to do with, you know, the limitation of the flesh, and, you know, you're going to die.
Right. So we are on a schedule.
That's right.
I'm sorry.
That's true. We are.
Okay. To some extent, reading Duplex for me was like listening to someone speak a language that I've only studied for a short period of time. And it was when I stopped trying so hard that I became just really drawn along and was able to understand, if I can put the term understand alongside the book, like I would with a language. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, I was like, there was a point where I was like, just let go and you will be fine. And that's how it was. So I wanted to know how this affects you as a writer, my saying that, and how would you like your readers to react to Duplex?
Well, that was a great way of describing how I would like a reader to read the book. I remember when I started writing, well, not when I really started, when I was little, but when I sort of seriously was writing, I started out writing poetry. And which I feel like I never understood how to write, really, so it was good that I stopped. But but I read a lot of poetry and have friends who write poetry. And once I was at a reading where someone said before he started reading, there are some long poems here, and they move around in some unusual ways. And really, please, don't try too hard to put on your, you know, reasonable thinking cap. Just sink down into it, because you will understand. It's not as if these poems are hard to understand. But if you start trying to organize what you're hearing in some way that you tend to organize listening to prose, logical prose, it's going to be frustrating. And I thought that was a very good way to describe, well, any, you know, reading, in fact, it's better to just turn a lot of those mechanisms off and drop down into whatever it is you're reading,
right,
like dropping into a body of water. And so that would be, for me, the ideal approach. I know that this book sort of immediately is messing around with logical connection and temporal connection,
mm-hmm,
and even spatial connection. And if you worry too much about that, then you're going to stop reading. I'm not a very logical person, or I can be logical, and I can be very organized, and I believe there is sort of an interior logic and organization to everything I've written, so that they're not just a whole lot of jumble of nothing, mm, all put into a book.
Yeah.
But I feel like the sort of intuitive side of the imagination is of great value in reading kind of anything. And and yeah, I know it's the part of me that's really operating when I'm writing.
Mm-hmm. I always find it difficult to decide whether or not to title chapters when I'm writing something of my own, and then to come up with the titles if I want them. This book titles chapters, and also there's the great title of the book, Duplex. So I wanted to ask you, what should a chapter title achieve, do you think? And how do you go about coming up with these, you know, titles of chapters and also the book title?
I knew I wanted the chapters to have titles. That was one of the things I sort of knew from the outset. And I think this goes back again to the sense of how the reader moves through the book,
mm-hmm,
and that the title, the chapter title, actually is another aspect of that transitional moment from being in one place and moving into another place, mm-hmm, without necessarily having a whole lot of logical explanation of how you're getting from point A to point B, so that the chapter titles are supposed to be doing some of that work.
Like a little grounding.
Yes.
Okay.
Like, here we are now. And sometimes they will make reference to something that the reader will find familiar, I think, from the previous chapter, so that chapter two is a house number, and we already know from chapter one that the house numbers are important.
Yeah.
And sometimes the chapter title is much more of a jump, suggesting to the reader that you're making a big step here. But just wait. I hope, as the reader keeps reading, that it becomes clear that even when you feel like you've sort of walked over a chasm, you're going to find out what the intervening space includes that got you from that, from one place to another.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted the titles to do that.
Did you have to work very hard to come up with each of them?
No. Mostly they seemed to suggest themselves pretty much right away. There were a couple of them that I did towards the end of the book. There were a few that I changed around some mm-hmm. to make more sense out of what I thought was going on there.
Yeah. I found them particularly helpful. Well, I found them helpful as I was reading, but I also found them helpful every once in a while. I would go back and kind of like flip through and look at them all again and realize, okay, you know, they just sort of helped me remember and then realize what was happening. You know what I mean?
Well, they make a kind of sequence,
yes.
I think.
Yeah.
And I like titled chapters in a book. That's something that is very appealing to me. And in my last book, in The Thin Place, there were no chapter titles mm-hmm. because it couldn't have had that. It had to all feel like it was one thing, even though it was in little parts. I didn't want... The chapter title suggests that you're entering something slightly new or different from what was there before.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so I like that.
Yeah. Now, some books will have just like the numbers, and then some books will have the narrative point of view mentioned at the front of the chapter, you know, so like Megan, you know, or...
Right.
And, but this book didn't do that, but I didn't particularly... Well, I mean, first of all, it's omniscient, but whoever we're reading about becomes very clear very quickly.
That's good.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's all, I hope, all held together by the omniscient narrator,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that there's not a real aggressive switching from internal point of view to internal
point
of view.
No. It was more like this is where the story is now, you know, each one. And then... The title of the book, Duplex. You said in our last interview that you often will have a title before you even start a project. Was that the case here?
No,
it
wasn't. And that was very unusual. But that was because there were a number of false starts, and they were false starts. Though in fact, each one of them had something in it that ended up being part of this book. There was always a part of something when I felt like I was barking up the wrong tree. There would be something that I thought made me feel very excited. But early on, I thought the book was going to be called Mrs. Duffy. And that character is the character who I believe became Miss Vicks.
Okay.
And I just liked Mrs. Duffy. I liked that title, and I sort of had an image of a world that she was in.
Mm-hmm.
And but then that completely deteriorated. And there were a number of other titles I entertained. Mm-hmm. I won't tell you all of them.
No,
but there
fine.
Were a lot of them.
Yeah.
And yet there were duplexes, you know, literally,
yeah.
In all these parts, there were duplexes,
uh-huh.
and I thought, at some point, not all that late in the composition, that would be a perfect title,
yeah,
and because it described the world of the book so perfectly, it's a beautiful word. I really love it, and it also was sort of true to my experience growing up. We grew up in duplexes. When we went to the shore, we were always in duplexes. It's a particular strange way to live where you hear other people. And anyway.
Yeah.
But it wasn't there from the beginning. And that was very unusual, really unusual for me.
How about your cover? And I'm always, it's funny, your covers are always so beautiful. And
thank you.
And they look like these gorgeous paintings. So this cover has a young man in a boat, which is relevant. But anyway, who did that?
I came up with the image.
Okay.
Because I went to art school.
Okay, right.
And in a way, sometimes I feel like, I may have said this before, but in a way I sort of feel like one of the main reasons to write a book is to get to have a cover.
You didn't say that before, I don't think.
I do believe that you can judge a book by its cover. I mean, they're really important to me. And so since my very first book, I have been involved in the choice of the cover, and it's even written into contracts that I've, you know, drummed up with a publisher, because I do not want a book to have a cover that I don't like.
Yeah.
So with this book, the first design that I thought would be perfect, this is a painting by Beau Bartlett, who also just really sort of coincidentally painted the painting that's on the cover of The Thin Place.
Is it? I wondered.
And I love his art, but I sort of didn't want to just always have the same artist doing the paintings on the covers of all my books.
Right.
But he had a painting just of the ocean, and I thought the cover should just be the ocean. And all the people at Grey Wolf thought that was great. And the designer came up with this beautiful design where there was a sort of circle cut in the center of the image and set back in slightly off kilter.
Oh, wow.
And then duplex written across it. And it was beautiful and everyone loved it. And then the distributors at Macmillan said, I'm sorry, we will not accept that cover.
Huh.
And they just really said no.
Who knew that distributors had that much?
They have a lot of power, because they say, I thought, this is a joke, come on, we can just do whatever we want here.
Yeah.
Who's going to listen to these dumb old distributors? But they have a lot of control over where the books go, and they had already made some kind of an arrangement with, you know, Barnes and Noble, that they said Barnes and Noble isn't going to want this book with this cover.
Hmm.
And I asked, well, you know, what's the problem with the cover? It seems so, I mean, it was hard to imagine what the problem could be. And it turned out that the Macmillan people thought it looked like a self-help book because it had an ocean on the cover.
Wow.
So then everyone at Grey Wolf reassured me that there would, whatever we came up with, it would be something I liked, and their designers did some things, and they already had this image, the image of this is called Lifeboat, a painting I love, and I said, well, I think we should just use that, and everyone liked it, and the Macmillan people liked it, because it doesn't look like a self-help book. And I actually think it's better. I think it's much more arresting than the former cover.
And you still get the tilted horizon, which I think does a little bit of what that circle might have done.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, I love it.
Now, you mentioned Grey Wolf, and they are a new publisher for you, correct?
Right.
This is your first publication with Grey Wolf. So how was it working with them?
I really love working with Grey Wolf, and I feel like what happened to me was that the former book had been published by Little Brown, and I was with an editor there who I'd been with for a very long time, and she wanted to buy Duplex, and the editor-in-chief at Little Brown said, I don't see how we're going to market this book.
Mm.
And I did know it was a peculiar book, It was a very upsetting moment.
Mm.
Moment makes it sound shorter than it was.
Time, there's time again.
Yeah, it was a bad thing to have happen. Except now I realize that it was in fact a very good thing, and that the kind of attention I've gotten from Grey Wolf. And the kind of attention I've gotten already early on in the publication of the book has everything to do with being with Grey Wolf, which is independent, an independent publisher. Everyone there was so enthusiastic about this book, mm-hmm. where often before, when I've been at a bigger, more conventional house, I mean, my editor has always been enthusiastic, and there'll be a person here, a person there, but they're always the people in the sales force or something who are giving you this funny look that I'm putting on my face right now. Like, so what? What is this book? And they always want to know, what can we say this book is like? They always want you to tell them that. And if you can't do it easily, which seems to me, you wouldn't want your book to be like some other book.
Right.
So if you can't do that easily, they get upset. And at Grey Wolf, everybody was happy that the book was not like other books. And so in that way, I feel like I'm in a place, you know, it's like I'm in the right family. Mm-hmm. Instead of being the sort of misfit in the big family where they're all going off to law school or something, I'm in a family that I belong in.
Right, right. Did you find Grey Wolf through your agent?
Or? Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right. And Grey Wolf is a nonprofit publisher.
Yeah.
Right? Is that unusual?
I think it is for the, well, certainly the bigger houses,
right,
are not that way.
Right.
I don't know. I think probably a lot of the bigger independent houses like Grey Wolf or Algonquin or... but there are, and my mind just went blank, there are a lot of good smaller houses that have now gotten bigger because I think really the future of certain kinds of publishing that used to be in the hands of the larger houses, like Farrar, Straus & Giroux, mm-hmm. Before they got bought up by whoever bought them up, they functioned more independently and were more daring in a way about mm-hmm. who they would publish and keeping books in print that weren't making buckets of money. So now these smaller houses, I believe, are doing that work.
And do you think that that's helping to reestablish a place for the mid-list author?
Yeah, I really do. Yeah. And I've been telling my students this forever. Mm-hmm. And using Grey Wolf, actually, as an example, even before I was at Grey Wolf, that if you're feeling discouraged about the future of publishing, you know, be not discouraged, because there are these houses that are still interested in the kind of work you're doing, and they're flourishing. Mm-hmm. They really are doing well. And the comparison I make, which is particularly appropriate for my students who are young people, is it's like the microbreweries, that they make these wonderful beers and ales that are keeping the, you know, the brewery system alive. I don't drink beer, but I know that this stuff is really good.
Yeah, right.
And it's, you know, meanwhile, Budweiser just keeps making Budweiser.
Right.
And so it's, I think there's a similarity there, though, really, with, and it probably similar to the whole kind of, you know, local vore food movement,
yeah.
where it's not necessarily better to be bigger.
Yeah, right. Great. I'm just going to ask you, and this may or may not have an answer, so maybe we won't end on this, but have you started working on anything else yet? Or?
I have.
Yeah.
I have. So far, at least, it's going sort of smoothly.
Oh, knock on wood.
Yeah, knock on wood. It's a little frustrating right now because I am preoccupied with some of the, you know, publication events. I'm not complaining.
No.
But it's taken me away from, you know, the kind of really quiet, concentrating time you need at your desk when you're working on a book.
Right.
But I am interested in what I'm writing. And
does it look like it'll be another novel?
They're always going to be novels.
Okay.
Or at least what I call novels.
great.
Yeah, someone asked me, well, would you rather call your books something other than novels? And I thought, well, no, I just write, you know, my kind of a novel. But I like the novel as a form because it does seem to me to be quite commodious. Mm-hmm. And it gives you a lot of room to do things. And it suggests an amplitude of time and space that a short story doesn't. So, yeah, it's another novel.
It's another novel. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed it.
Well, you're very welcome. I've had a great time.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author Catherine Davis. You can learn more about her work at her publisher's website, graywolfpress.org. So recently it struck me that I am sleeping better lately, and also that I know a lot of people who, like me, were not sleeping particularly well in 2020, some of whom still are not. Plenty of reasons could be discussed at length about why, but instead, let's write about them. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about sleep. Deep, happy sleep, fitful sleep, dreams, half-interrupted, half-dreams, involuntary dozing in meetings, Zoom meetings maybe, naps, medications, sleepwalking, waking unexpectedly to something you can't quite name. There's a lot to work with because sleep is universally vital. So good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Once again, I am encouraging you to please support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs, and going on their virtual book tours, finding your way to their books. In this time when authors' launches are being canceled, book tours are being canceled, it's such a challenge, even more than usual, to get word out about books. For all of you who are trying to write these days, do be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast through my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, do please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.